Yeah, the factual background of this case is relatively straightforward. The facts giving rise to the injuries to Dirk Bauer was that there was an unsecured staircase at a residential construction site. It was unattended. Our client stepped on it. The staircase collapsed, and he had suffered serious injuries as a result. The course of the proceedings in this case were relatively easy to predict. Both of the plaintiffs filed suit against the defense, Trent Chappelle and Southwest Construction Company, given the circumstances surrounding the collapse. The lawsuit itself wasn't surprising. The fact that the defense chose to defend this case by blaming Dirk Bauer was also not surprising. Prior to trial beginning, our client and plaintiff's counsel anticipated, and this was something that was also not surprising, anticipated that one of the tactics that the defense would use during trial is to try and suggest to the jury by way of expert witness testimony that the regulations of the Occupational Safety Act, otherwise known as the OSHA Act, were inapplicable to this case because Dirk Bauer was not an employee of the defendants. We anticipated that this was going to happen, and prior to any testimony being given, plaintiff's counsel stood up and asked the court to rule as a motion in limine that to preclude the defendants from suggesting this kind of testimony. And the trial judge agreed. And the trial judge found that such testimony was irrelevant to this case and would be confusing to the jury, and told the defense explicitly that they should not elicit such testimony.
Ms. Krulwich, does your client take issue with the instruction pertinent to the OSHA issues that the trial court did give, instruction 23?
No, that instruction, to the extent that instruction is accurate, it just doesn't cover the error in this case. It really doesn't address the employer-employee issue at all, and that's the issue. And I think had the defense not injected what was clearly irrelevant, improper testimony and ignored the trial court's instruction, the instructions given to the jury would have been fine then. But what happened was, over and over and over again, the defense, irrespective of what the trial court's order was, and irrespective of the fact that every time they tried to inject this issue, it was objected to and the trial court sustained the objection, they continued to insinuate into this case and suggest to the jury that the OSHA Act was completely inapplicable because of the relationship between the parties.
I'm sorry. Your position, as I understand it, Ms. Krulwich, is that the OSHA doesn't create a duty to the public. What OSHA does is it's relevant as to a standard of care once you have a duty established. So in this case, how could the trial court be wrong in giving that exact instruction?
The trial court wasn't wrong in giving that instruction. What the trial court erred in is not, because of the continued attempts of the defense to inject this. The defense tried to suggest to the jury through numerous witnesses that the OSHA Act was inapplicable to this case because it doesn't create any duties that flow from employer to employee.
But couldn't the jury here have simply decided, on the strength of the record and the evidence adduced at trial, that even if a duty was owed, Chappell wasn't negligent?
I think it would have been very difficult for the jury to have concluded, on the basis of the record here, that the defense wasn't negligent at all. And remember, Judge, that in this case, one of the issues was the indemnification issue and whether Capital Pacific Homes had a right to be indemnified. If the defense was found to be even 1% at fault, then Capital Pacific Homes would have been entitled to indemnification. And I think under the strength of this record, I mean, what we have is we have the owner of Southwest Construction, and this came in through one of the defense experts. The owner didn't actually testify at trial, but his deposition testimony came in through one of the defense experts, and he admitted that what Southwest Construction did in terms of safety relative to this incident was substandard. We have the OSH Act, which requires, and the defendants in this case were contractually obligated to comply with the OSH Act, which, you know, makes it even more egregious, I think, for the defense to suggest to the jury that OSH Act was inapplicable in this case. And the OSH Act requires a couple of things. It requires that any time there's an unsecured and unattended staircase, that there either be a warning or a barricade. That didn't happen in this case. So I think when you look at these facts, and this was established through both plaintiffs and defense experts, and when you look at those facts, the fact that the jury didn't even assign 1% of fault to the defense strongly suggests that they were confused on this duty issue.
But pardon me. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
Ms. Krulwich, I want to throw out five things. The first is we have a proper written instruction given to the jury at the end. Second, we have a proper oral instruction given to the jury during the proceedings. Third, every time this issue was raised, the court sustained objections. Fourth, we have a proper jury instruction saying that the jury is not to consider evidence that the court has kept out. And last of all, we have... Well, maybe there are only four things, but based on those four things, it strikes me that the jury, not only was the jury properly instructed, both orally and in writing, but there is no basis here for what you've just said that is clear from the record. What we have is we've got a court properly telling the jury what to do, and while I understand that you would have preferred a different outcome, nonetheless, Your client was allowed to introduce, here's number five, introduce those OSHA regs, and the jury heard a lot of testimony about them. So how can you say that the reason that the jury returned this is because of this testimony that was excluded by the court through granting your objections?
Well, here's why I can say this, Judge, is that it's true that to the extent, had there been no error here, and remember, the court at the beginning, we anticipated that the defense was going to do exactly what they did in this case. We anticipated the defense was going to try and suggest, because the OSHA Act hurt them. The regulations of the OSHA Act were very detrimental to them in this case, so they were bending over backwards to try and diminish any relevance of the OSHA Act. So we anticipated that they were going to suggest to the jury, based on the status of the parties, that it didn't apply and that it didn't create duties between the parties. The trial court at the beginning said to plaintiff's counsel, you're right, and instructed the defense that they could not get into that because it was irrelevant and it would confuse the jury. When these instances happened, and there were four different instances. It was very deliberate, Judge. And there were four different instances. We objected every time, and each time it was sustained, but the judge never clarified the issue. The instructions that the jury got to as far as they went were accurate, but it didn't address the harm that was caused by the conduct of defense by eliciting this testimony. So I think that that's how we make this argument, and I think it's very legitimate. What we had was a jury that was misled by improper evidence, and I think it's also worth noting that even though the trial judge sustained the objections, he never struck the testimony. He never gave any instruction to tell the jury that what the defense did was wrong. And in fact, the first instruction that he gave on the OSHA Act was extremely long and very, very confusing. So in light of that, and I think that there's two separate harms here. One harm is that the jury could have decided the duty issue, which was absolutely inappropriate for a jury to decide. They're there to rule on questions of fact.
Do you have anything besides speculation to support that argument?
I think that the verdict itself, Judge, in light of the testimony, supports that.
Ms. Krulwich, but why is it the trial court's duty you know, give an additional instruction that's different and even goes beyond what the law allows, what, you know, the Scott v. Matlack case allows. Why wasn't it counsel's duty to point out the party's agreement? And the party's agreement specifically said OSHA applied, you know, as between these parties. You know, I think the employee-employer issue really becomes a red herring. You just go back to the contract. I mean, the contract rebuts that attempt to inject this suggestion that because there's not an employee-employer relationship, that OSHA is not applicable. I mean, why isn't it counsel's duty to correct that misconception or misinformation?
Counsel tried to correct that by requesting the instruction that the jury be instructed, you know, to that effect at the conclusion of the case. I mean, those objections were made, but, you know, it wasn't adequate enough. I mean, what the defense did, and I'm going to make a short comment here, and then I'm going to sit down and reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. But what the defense did is twofold. It, number one, allowed the jury to, it suggested to the jury that there was no duty between the parties, and that simply wasn't true, and the trial judge had ruled beforehand that the defense was not to get into that. What it also did was it diminished and really encouraged the jury to disregard any evidence of the OSHA Act, because it was basically saying, the OSHA Act doesn't apply here. So I will reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you.
May I please support?
Counsel, as I understand the record, the plaintiff proposed a curative instruction at the close of the evidence. The judge refused it. The judge had an instruction that the judge intended to give the jury, and counsel acquiesced in it.
Yes, Your Honor, I believe you're referring to the issue of comments of counsel.
Yes.
During closing argument.
Your Honor, precisely.
The factual circumstances in which that issue arose, there was initially testimony from the workers' compensation carrier Justin Freer that Mr. Barr's workers' compensation claim remained open. In closing argument, defense counsel reasonably utilized that testimony to suggest that Mr. Barr was going to continue to have workers' compensation benefits into the future. The jury was specifically instructed as to the proper means in which it was to consider that testimony, and that they were not to reduce future damages based upon Mr. Barr's entitlement to collect workers' compensation benefits. What happened immediately after that, there was no contemporaneous objection during the closing argument. It was only after closing argument that the plaintiffs objected, filed a motion over the weekend. The closing argument happened to be on a Friday afternoon. They filed a motion seeking clarification or additional instruction on Sunday evening. On Monday morning, the parties appeared at trial before jury deliberations, and the parties discussed and the court offered to further clarify the issue, and plaintiffs simply did not agree or didn't like the language of that additional instruction, which happened to be an accurate statement of the law as it exists, and simply chose not to have the court further instruct the jury, and defense did not object to that.
And this is an issue, of course, that's put in a matter that's put in issue by the plaintiff.
It is, Your Honor.
Through their indemnification claim.
It is, Your Honor. And let me just say, with respect to that particular issue, it's important, I think, to remember and to keep in mind that the issue of damages is irrelevant to these proceedings, because the jury, in fact, found that the plaintiff himself was solely negligent for any injuries and damages that he may have sustained. So, it's irrelevant to the question that if the jury's did not believe the plaintiff was entitled to damages, any error with respect to those damages certainly was harmless.
One other matter. Ms. Krowich indicated in her argument that here there's an absolute OSHA violation because there was no warning or barricade. As I understand the record, there was testimony that, in fact, there was a warning, and there was testimony that a barricade was put up.
Your Honor, There were four separate experts, all of whom testified extensively about OSHA regulations, specifically about warnings, whether they were written warnings, verbal warnings. In fact, all three defense experts testified that Mr. Barr had been verbally instructed on more than one occasion on the morning of the accident that these stairs were unsecured and they could be a potential danger to him. On all of those occasions, each of the defense experts and I believe even the plaintiff's expert testified that verbal warnings are adequate in the industry and meet the standard of care for purposes of warnings. Written warnings are simply unnecessary. And this gets to the issue of OSHA itself. And I think, Your Honor, you pointed it out well, and the panel has noted and brought the issue up that there was no absence of opportunity for OSHA to come into play in terms of whether or not the defendants violated OSHA or not. Extensive testimony was given on regulations that OSHA would provide for purposes of protecting people on a construction site. So to suggest that the plaintiffs or either side was somehow deprived of the opportunity to present that type of evidence is simply not accurate. One of the I think misinterpretations, at least, and it goes back to the Scott case, is there's a confusion here between the court making a determination that a party owes a duty to the other and the jury having the ability and freedom to be able to determine what the standard of care is. The court in this case made that threshold determination prior to trial that the defendants did in fact owe a duty to the plaintiff in this case. That was addressed in the pretrial motions. However, when you go back to the Scott case makes a specific distinction between adopting or a party being able to utilize the regulatory scheme of a body of law, for example, OSHA in this case, in a general negligence claim, using that, but distinguishing it from whether it actually applies to the case. And that's the crux of the matter here. The jury, the court was not deprived of any legal authority it had to make determinations of duty or questions of law. It made that determination, but it was the jury's the jury had the freedom to be able to hear from the experts what the standard of care was and whether there was a breach of that standard of care. I think the Scott case makes perfectly clear that the jury has essentially the ultimate discretion. They can accept or they can reject in its entirety evidence of OSHA and whether it applies in this situation. The defendants attacked the weight of OSHA, of the OSHA evidence in two regards. One, the defendants attacked the fact that OSHA, that this situation in which these stairs were being constructed constituted a condition which is known in the industry as being in transition or in progress. And all of the defense experts testified that OSHA does not address those types of occasions on a construction site, and therefore OSHA had no applicability to this situation.
Counsel, but how could your client credibly argue that OSHA had no application in this case, especially vis-a-vis the employee-employer relationship, when, you know, one, the trial court had already made decided that there was a duty, and two, when the parties had a contract that specifically referenced and, you know, and invoked OSHA? Why shouldn't we hold that it was improper for you to try to insert that issue into the trial or your client?
It's important to remember that the contract that was in existence here was between two companies. It was between Capital Pacific Homes and one of the defendants, Southwest Construction. The contract, a reasonable interpretation of the contract would be that the defendant, Southwest, was required to comply with OSHA with respect to the employees with respect to the work they were doing on the project, meaning that Capital Pacific Homes put that language in there, not to suggest that Southwest had to comply with OSHA with respect to its obligations towards Capital Pacific, but that Southwest employed, that it would ensure that Southwest employees, as the employer and its employees, that relationship, that it would make sure that it was providing a safe work environment for its own employees, not for the employees of Capital Pacific. So there's a distinction. I know that the contract was not clear, that the parties did not say that Southwest agrees to be bound by all OSHA regulations with respect to the work it does with respect to Capital Pacific and its employees. And that really comes back down to the issue, like the employer, that we've talked about, the employer-employee issue here. One of the reasons why defendants attempted to elicit testimony about that, the context of OSHA in that relationship, is because the very language of OSHA itself only places an obligation on employers to their employees. And it went to the weight of the evidence in terms of why OSHA should not be applied in this situation.
But nonetheless, the trial court, as Ms. Krulwich has pointed out, and we have pointed out, sustained every time you got into that got sustained, right?
That's true, Your Honor.
And so that evidence, by sustaining that evidence was, the jury was told, basically, that they couldn't consider that. I understand there was no specific statement of that, but when the objection is sustained, they were later instructed that if the court sustained an objection, you can't consider the evidence, right?
That's absolutely right, Your Honor.
So don't we trust jurors to follow the instructions of the court?
We absolutely do. And in light of the Colorado Supreme Court's most recent pronouncement with respect to that issue in Quest v. Blood, great deference is supposed to be given to juries, absent some evidence to the contrary. We in Colorado trust juries to follow the instructions of the court. And that was articulated perhaps most poignantly recently in the Blood case. With respect to, and I just want to address at the very end, I'm happy to address any other questions that the panel has. The plaintiffs in this case have suggested or encouraged the court to adopt for the first time a cumulative errors doctrine, and defendants suggest that doctrine has never been applied to civil cases here in Colorado, and that no single error, let alone multiple errors, justify applying that or expanding that doctrine today. I think it's also important, and I want to go back, Your Honor, to your last comment, if I may, for a moment. It's defendant's position that the court in this case erred on the side of the plaintiffs. While we think it would indeed have been proper to allow the defendants to inquire into the employer-employee issue for purposes of the weight of the evidence with respect to OSHA, the court did indeed preclude the defendants from doing that. Now, the defendants only did that of their own volition on one occasion. On several other occasions, that testimony was elicited from defendants, from defendants' experts, not from defense counsel, but from the plaintiff's counsel. And in fact, the biggest exchange came on the direct examination of defendants' third expert, Dr. Hollowell. And it was only on redirect examination that the defense counsel sought to clarify that issue, because the door had been opened by the plaintiffs, and yet at the same time the plaintiffs were attempting to enjoy the shield of protection from the trial court with respect to how far they could get in to whether or not to the applicability of OSHA. And it's quite clear from the Scott case that application of OSHA is up to the jury. That's not necessarily up to the court. In fact, the court in Scott specifically mentioned that it was declining to rule on the issue of whether or not OSHA applies, can be applied to a situation where an injured party is not the employee of the employer. It specifically reserved ruling on that. It simply said, once the court determines there's a duty, it's up to the jury to determine through expert testimony what the standard of care is and whether a regulatory body that's borrowed applies. And in this case, all defendants were doing throughout trial was trying to convince the jury that OSHA does not apply to the factual circumstances as they existed. Therefore, we'd respectfully request the court affirm the judgment of the trial court. Thank you.
Thank you. I have just under 4 minutes remaining.
Thank you, Judge. I think what Mr. Meyer just said is very apropos. He basically admitted that what the defense was trying to do throughout this trial was to encourage the jury to rule on a question of law, what the applicability of OSHA. And that was absolutely inappropriate for them to do. Now, and the reason that this is so significant, and Judge Graham brought up the issue of the verbal warning. There was testimony that Dirk Barr was warned verbally. Initially, Trent Chappelle, who was the subcontractor that was in charge of securing the stairs, he testified at his deposition that he warned Mr. Barr during their early morning meeting at 7 o'clock in the morning not to get on the stairs. He was told that these stairs needed to be done by 3 o'clock because there were homeowners coming through. So that was the deadline for him. It was not until trial that he ever said that he warned Mr. Barr immediately preceding him getting on the stairs. And OSHA regulations do not contemplate that a verbal warning would be a substitute for a physical warning or a visual cue that the stairs were unsafe. And that's the reason that there was such a battle over OSHA regulations, because OSHA doesn't contemplate that. OSHA recognizes, and there was expert testimony to this effect, the reason you require a visual cue is because it's out of recognition that a construction site is a busy place, that superintendents of construction sites and subcontractors and people that are working on a construction site, they are multitasking. They have lots of different things going on. And so to rely on someone's memory versus a physical sign to show that something is unsafe, that's what OSHA requires. It requires a physical warning. A verbal warning doesn't suffice. By suggesting to the jury that OSHA didn't apply, that was the defense inappropriately urging the jury to disregard that part of OSHA. So, I think that's critically important here. The barricade that was in place, I think that's indicative of the fact that Mr. Chappelle knew that there needed to be a barricade, but the barricade was removed when he went to lunch, and he didn't bother to replace it. So, and at that point, he didn't do anything to replace it, and then he left. And what he did was he left an unsecured staircase with no visual sign at all. And remember, the testimony was undisputed that right before Dirk Barr stepped on the steps, he saw Trent Chappelle using the steps himself. So what Dirk Barr saw was a person that was using the steps, and then he went off and checked something else on another floor of the house, and came back and reasonably believed that the steps were secure with no visual or warning or barricade to suggest otherwise. He stepped on the steps and they collapsed beneath him. In terms of the workers' compensation issue that Judge Graham alluded to, that was a situation very similar to the OSHA Act situation, where we anticipated that the defense was going to do exactly what they did and suggest to the jury that they didn't need to worry. I mean, what the workers' compensation statement did was it told the jury that their verdict wasn't going to make any difference because Dirk Barr was going to be taken care of irrespective of their verdict. And that obviously was very prejudicial. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you to both of you for your fine arguments. The case is deemed submitted, and you may expect a written opinion in due course.